Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. You are not alone.
So our guest is Dr. Andy Thompson, and he is a psychiatrist at University of Virginia Student Health Services. The 9/11 attacks triggered interest in suicide terrorism, which led to the discovery of an unappreciated world of research into how and why human minds generate religious beliefs. Now, Dr. Thompson has written Why We Believe in Gods, a concise guide to the science of faith, which brings that world to anybody interested. So I am super excited to hear what Dr. Thompson has to share with us today. So welcome, Dr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Now, you've been on here a couple of times just in 2021 and really done some excellent presentations for us. So I can't thank you enough for being here again.
Oh, well, again, thank you for having me. Thanks to Eric. Thanks to Sherry for the invitation, for the introduction. Also, it's special for me. It's a long time since I've seen Dr. Ray, and a shout out to him and a thank you because, as Sherry said, I got interested in the psychology of religion, and one of the books I discovered and the work I discovered was his. So thank you. Thank you for all your work, and thanks for being here tonight. It's great to see you. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the psychology of happiness and well-being. And this is obviously important in general, but we know that people who leave religion oftentimes are plunged into aloneness and loneliness because so many of their attachments can be ruptured. And as you will see, one of the most important things for happiness and well-being, particularly long-term well-being, is attachments. And my goal tonight, a couple of goals, really, is to give you at least my take on the science of happiness and well-being. That's the first goal. The second is that I never want you to look at a AAA battery again in the same way, and you'll understand why. And also, as I go through this, to point out things that I think are relevant to recovering from religion, to people who have left religion. And I hope you all will see things that I haven't. Also, we'll see, I think, why the pandemic has been even worse emotionally than we anticipated and I think still don't believe. And so, again, What I would argue is that all of the research, if you look at it, comes under three headings, can be understood as agency, attachments, and altruism. And we've already heard about volunteering. And we'll go through those three, but before that, a little background going into it. Again, we're in the middle of a pandemic that doesn't seem to be going away, and the world has been profoundly affected. It's had huge impacts on emotional health. And as I said, as we go through this, I hope you will see some of the reasons the pandemic has hit us even harder than we anticipated. The idea of happiness and well-being is an ancient one. Here's a quote from Aristotle: the meaning and purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence, the aim and end of human existence. And when we say those words, happiness and well-being, they're all familiar to us. But if we think about what they're actually made up of, it can be kind of obscure trying to describe, well, what are the elements? And there's also a paradox to it, because happiness and well-being refer to feeling states, yet many, as we'll see, of the activities that help with long-term well-being are not associated with any particular feeling. And we also know that if you just say, okay, I'm going to do everything possible to make myself happy, that's generally a recipe for an unhappy life. To give a little history here, this is Carol and Ed Diener. Carol Diener is a clinical psychologist, also a lawyer. She worked with juvenile delinquents. Her husband, Ed, research psychologist at University of Illinois. And Ed, and I think Carol, but Ed is given the credit, had a brilliant insight in the late 80s. And he realized that there really was no science of happiness and well-being. We had all these years of psychological research, scientific methods, science in psychology, and no one had systematically applied it to happiness and well-being. And this is the godfather of the revolution. And some of his students and disciples, like Marty Seligman, have become more famous in a way. But this is the man that started it, and the whole revolution really comes from Ed, the positive psychology movement, and in some sense, all of what I'm going to tell you tonight. Now, I had them ask you the questions about percentages, and one of the things that has come out of the research is this, that the genetic contribution to well-being and happiness is only about 50%. And this comes from twin studies. And circumstances, only 10%. And 40%, almost half of the factors that go into happiness and well-being are associated with intentional activities. And so what this means is that the decisions we make, the way we conduct our lives, the things that we do, we can make intentional actions that will help with giving us happiness and well-being. And don't worry about the details of this slide. I put it up here to show you a couple of things that people ask me, well, what's the neurochemistry? Is it dopamine? Is it serotonin? What is it? And it's the usual culprits that well-being and happiness is going to be dopamine, the pleasure chemical, but dopamine is also motivation, attention, focus, activity, all sorts of things. The endorphins, your internal morphine, your internal opium, which people think of as pain and runner's high. Endorphins are crucial for attachments. Our own internal cannabinoids, our internal marijuana, which helps with anxiety, with memory, with all sorts of functions. So there's no one particular chemical for happiness and well-being. It's the usual suspects that have to do with pleasure. The other reason I put this this picture up is because to show you that a lot of it is in the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex. And that's what makes us human. And that's also, particularly if you see that OFC, the orbital frontal cortex, that's the home of the attachment mechanisms and our decisions about our behavior. So a lot of this is frontal lobe. One of the difficulties researching this is the difference between what is termed the experiencing self versus the remembering self. What does this mean? Well, for instance, let's say tomorrow you go on a hike up a steep mountain and I phone you and you're halfway up the mountain and I ask you how you're feeling. You might say, well, I'm kind of tired and sweaty and, I'm not so sure I should have done this. And you get up to the top of the mountain and it's at a beautiful sunset and your memory is one of well-being and happiness. And so at times there's trouble. There's differences measuring this. And the experiencing self is more, happiness, which is a fleeting emotion. And a lot of our happy moments, don't register on the camera. And you want to think of happiness and satisfaction. And satisfaction is more long-term and it's memory. And memory predominates. Another example is think about you plan for a vacation, you have the vacation, and then there are the memories of the vacation. Which lasts the longest? It's those memories. Another way of looking at it is, what if you could go on a vacation, but you couldn't take photographs, and when you got back from the vacation, all the memories were wiped away. And so I hope you see this is one of the difficulties in measuring happiness and researching it. And a researcher named Killingsworth in Massachusetts did, I think, beautiful research looking at that experiencing self. And there are huge numbers, and people would wear a beeper, and he could beep them at any time and do an assay of how they were feeling at the moment. And what he discovered was that in terms of the experiencing self, when our minds are wandering, when we're bored, we tend to be unhappy. When we are engaged in something purposeful, when we're doing something, we tend to feel better. And so it's going to be pleasure and purpose. Now, I want to give a little bit, people have heard my talks before. I'm very interested in evolutionary psychology. I think it's the basis of psychology. And just to review a little bit of that. So we're risen apes, not fallen angels. We're just a few chromosomes away from a chimpanzee. We share, I think, 98%. We're a primate. We're an ape. We're an African ape. We're a mammal. We're a vertebrate. And it's very hard for all of us to get our minds around the time scales involved in this. If you just take our genus, Homo, Homo habilis, you know, shows up 2.4 million years ago. And as I think I gave the example last time, if you take a 24-hour clock divided into 100,000 years per hour, like midnight last night is when our genus Homo shows up in Africa. It's not until, 10 o'clock tonight that Homo sapiens shows up. And it's not until like 6 minutes before midnight that we start to settle down in agricultural communities in the Near East, probably to brew better beer. And so we evolved in a context that's much different from the one we live in today. And you always want to keep in mind that the evolutionary past frames the experience present, that any fundamental aspects of human nature evolved in our hunter-gatherer past over millions of years. Life was an endless camping trip with close relatives. And so one of the things I would submit to you, which at one level is obvious, but I don't think you see many people writing about it, is that we shouldn't be surprised if what we discover constitutes happiness and well-being would be the things that would constitute happiness and well-being in a hunter-gatherer tribe. This is why people aren't, that happy if they win the lottery or have a Mercedes. I mean, the key elements to happiness and well-being are going to be the same things that contributed to well-being and happiness among our hunter-gatherer ancestors, because that was the environment of evolutionary adaptedness. But we have a mismatch, and I'll talk about this some. So when you see problems in human nature, one of the things to think about is the mismatch between what we were evolved to do and what we're structured to do in hunter-gatherer environments and the environments that we live in today. All of us have cravings for sugar, but it was the sugar of ripe fruits, not the sugar of Coca-Cola. And that's a mismatch. And a lot of our troubles come from a mismatch between the environment we were designed for and the environment we live in now. So let's look at agency. What is meant by this? Okay. Agency is this. I thought this is the best slide, that you're not always exclusively dancing to other people's tune. You are at times and hopefully a lot of times dancing to your own tune. And it's connected with a sense of being effective, being able to impact things, being able to make things happen. Also mattering and making a difference. And there's a wonderful new psychology people are looking at, which again is an offshoot of happiness, well-being, and positive psychology, the whole psychology of mattering. And it's crucial. Some of the evidence, which I think is fun. If I just ask you to play in a dice game and you have, you don't know anything about the research, and I just monitor you playing with some other people in a dice game, and think, when you roll a dice, it's completely random. But when you roll the dice, you will bet more than when I roll the dice. It's a guarantee. You know, when you're in charge, when you have agency of those dice, even though it's a random outcome, you're going to bet more. Now, if you came home tonight and saw this, what would you do? Right? Look at the smile on that boy's face. Now, I'll confess, before I got into this research, if I'd come home to this, I would have been one annoyed father. I'm not sure. I wouldn't have been real happy. Now, I hope I would back off a bit, because what is childhood? Childhood is practicing the strategies and behaviors of adulthood. And these boys are trying to do something. They're trying to make a, they're trying to have impact. They're trying to you know, learn the painting. I mean, you know, maybe they've heard of Jackson Pollock. I don't know. But at any rate, they're doing something that they're proud of, and you can see it. And we would tend to interpret it as they're naughty. We'd punish them. And I would hope now, if I saw this, I'd say, you know, this was not a good idea. Could you help Dad clean it up? But just look at the face of that boy on the left, the older one. I just love it. Now, let's go to the other end of the age spectrum, into nursing homes, and a brilliant piece of research. So people in nursing homes, and they give the resident of the nursing home a plant, and the nursing staff takes care of the plant. Then in the other group, they give the nursing home resident a plant, but the nursing home resident is responsible for taking care of that plant. That's the only difference. That's the only variable. And statistically significant, the nursing home residents who take care of the plant live longer. The ones who are, you know, it's taken care of for them die sooner. I think it's just brilliant and fascinating research. So agency, let's look at attachments, right? And I think in one of my previous talks, I talked about Mary Ainsworth and John Bowlby, who mapped out attachment in humans. And I can't emphasize them enough. I think I suggested it last time. I'll suggest it again. Look at an article in The Atlantic from 1990 on becoming attached by Robert Caron. It's still, you can pull it up very easily. And the beauty of the article is both of them were still alive at the time and were interviewed. And they come to life in that article. And he wrote a subsequent book, but you can get a huge sense of it just by reading that article. And so we are born with these extraordinary attachment mechanisms, neonatal attachment mechanisms, infantile attachment mechanisms, childhood, that they're absolutely crucial. And they're the basic mammalian attachment mechanisms, but we've taken them to a whole new level. Now, the basic attachment mechanism is the mother-child, and it's the basis of all attachments. Robin Dunbar in England has done some great work to show that basically this fundamental mother-child attachment mechanism, this is the foundation for friendships, romantic relationships, good colleagueships, is the basic attachment mechanism. But as I go through the next couple of slides, I want you to look at the faces and the eyes. Now, notice the face-to-face and the eye-to-eye. All right. I want to introduce you to your 65 million year old mother. This is thought to be the first species of primates or near primates at the time of dinosaurs, and they were tiny. But what was crucial about them is that they were able to produce high frequency. It's thought that they were able to produce high frequency sounds that they could connect with each other, and the dinosaurs and reptiles would not pick up on it. But they managed to survive and prosper in the midst of, before the dinosaurs went extinct. But this is our earliest primate ancestor. And we carry traits of this species in us. This is the foundational stone of primates. It looks like a mouse. It's the size of a paperclip. And if you look it up, it's called Purgatorius. And if you Google Purgatorius, information will pull up, and it's thought to be the original primate. We're primates, and this is thought to be the original primate or neo-primate that lived at the time of dinosaurs, that survived the dinosaurs, that survived the Great Extinction when the meteorite hit, and they could communicate with each other through high-frequency sounds that the dinosaurs and reptiles and potential predators couldn't pick up on. All right. So you hear in the mental health business this stuff about self-regulation or self-regulation of affect or something like that. I want you to discard that, because the dyad is the unit of the mammal, right? It is the dyad. And obviously, I show it all the time. This is one of my favorite pictures, Jane Goodall and one of her elderly chimps. But it's the dyad. It is co-regulation, not self-regulation of emotion. It is always co-regulation. And we experience the world and process the world through other people's eyes. I mean, if you just look at this talk that I'm giving tonight, everything that I'm giving you, you know, comes from other people that I've processed and experienced through other people's eyes, their research, their thinking, their writing. So, we're an ultra social species, and this is why we're successful. That's why we're the last, one of the reasons we're the last surviving hominid. And Again, and there's much more to connection than I think most of us realize. Certainly there's much more than I realized till I started researching this. And the idea here is that connection is a deep biological imperative. And face-to-face connection is crucial. The prosody of our speech conveys tons of information. We have very specific adaptations to interpret the prosody of speech. You're doing that and you're not even conscious of it when you're listening to me. You're making interpretations based on the tone and the volume and all sorts of things, very specific adaptations, gestures, and we'll talk a lot about touch. But it connection with people, the attachment with people, interacting with people is a deeply biological imperative. And I love this. A friend of mine at Central State Hospital in Petersburg gave it to me. It's an old African saying, "I am because we are." And keep that in mind. Now, I don't know about you, but I grew up on The Lone Ranger and one of my favorite television shows. And it never occurred to me as a child that, wait a second, The Lone Ranger was never alone. He was never alone. He always had Tonto bailing him out, right? I mean, and yet he was called The Lone Ranger. I mean, if you think about it, it's nuts. I mean, it obviously has something to do with white whatever, but you know, so the idea that the notion of the Marlboro man, the rugged individual, just, I mean, you want to put that in the delete file. If you've not seen the movie Castaway, I would recommend it for a number of reasons. Number one, it's a great movie. But number two, it is a fantastic visual description of the attachment mechanism. I'm not giving away much here, but Tom Hanks is in a plane crash. Everybody dies. It's a like a FedEx thing with a lot of packages in it. He washes up on an island. He's all by himself. And there's a bunch of packages that weren't delivered. And one of them is a soccer ball. He cuts his hand pretty badly. And he takes the blood and he draws a face on this ball. And he calls it Wilson. And Wilson is his companion on the island. And they have this very intense relationship. And I think it's just an extraordinary portrayal of the nature of human connection that's drawn out in this movie and his attachment to Wilson, which contributes significantly to what happens to him. A way of thinking about connection or relationships is when you connect with somebody and it's good, and then you feel safe, right? And you have to turn off some systems, you know, to feel safe. You lower your vigilance. There's all sorts of biological things that go into feeling safe. If there's any kind of threat, your fight flight mechanism starts to turn on. And if there is extreme threat, we have this ancient mammalian mechanism of immobilization and dissociation. Why is this important? Unfortunately, too many rape survivors feel like they in some way contributed to their rape because they froze and they shouldn't have, that shouldn't have happened. They should have been able to say no. They should have been able to push back. And so it's somehow their fault. And when you come across that, you really want to argue hard against that. When somebody is beaten up on themselves because they froze, it's an ancient involuntary mechanism when we are under threat. If you remember the Atlanta Olympic bombing and they had the film of all the people in the park, the bomb goes off, nobody ran, everybody froze. It's just involuntary, immediate. Okay. And I'd like you to think about trauma a little bit differently. I think most people think of PTSD simply from the point of the individual, flashbacks, hypervigilance, traumatic memory, nightmares. But I think you want to add into that that the worst part about trauma is that it ruptures these capacities, these deep biological capacities for connection, for attachment. And it ruptures that ability to co-regulate and to connect to somebody without fear. So when we feel safe with somebody, you know, we're immobilized, we're quiet, and we're quiet without fear. And that gets lost in trauma. People can't be quiet and immobilize without fear. It also removes the capacity for safe social engagement from one's basic repertoire. And our defenses, our psychological defenses shift to, if we do immobilize, it's always with fear and often with shutdown. People who are traumatized become silent, they withdraw. And this is automatic and unconscious and one of the tragedies of trauma. And obviously, trauma lowers our threshold to dissociate. People with bad PTSD are dissociating almost instantly if something is making them anxious. And just sometimes closeness can make somebody anxious. I saw a patient this week and, you know, she's trying to build a relationship with somebody. And anytime there's a move towards closeness, and she's quite open about it, she gets anxious and boom, she immobilizes, dissociates, and has to back off. And this is somebody who's had multiple traumas and is trying to recover from it.
Dr. Andy,
yes.
Can you tell us just briefly about what dissociation means? From what I hear you're saying, it seems like they lose sense of where they currently are and are,
yes,
are then going back to a past event.
Well, they may not. A lot of people that dissociate they just go blank.
Okay.
They're not there. It's almost like it's, and it's thought to be kind of its origins are when an animal was attacked by a predator, going completely limp and making the predator think they were already dead, which sometimes would get the animal to back off. And so basically you're freeze. And I mean, that is thought to be the origin of it. You can't fight, you can't flee. So you act as if you're dead, and an animal might not, you know, if you're dead, they might, you know, it's risky right to eat you. And that's what's thought to be the deep origin of this. It's an automatic, involuntary, physiologic response.
Thank you. I can imagine being in a situation like that, and I would just like pass out, fall dead, and shit my pants.
Right.
And smell like I'd be dead too.
Right. Exactly. Good point. No, that's actually a good point. You would defecate, which is when an animal is dead, their bowels loosen up and defecate, and it would add to it. You'd smell dead, and maybe the predator would move away. It's a very good point. I see it all the time in rape victims, and it's tragic because they'll immobilize and then they'll blame themselves. They should have been able to fight the guy off. So they're somehow at fault if they got raped. They're responsible. It's really tough.
Thank you.
These are childhood survivors. These are survivors of the Holocaust who were children during the Holocaust. And what you see in them is that, yes, they became functional. And many of them lived long lives, but many of them were severely impaired. If you're interested in this, there's a wonderful book on the history of Israel, My Promised Land, and the descriptions of the Holocaust survivors in Tel Aviv in the 50s and 60s is heartbreaking. Now, another way of thinking about attachment mechanisms and our this deep biologic need for attachment is that it really is a face-heart connection. You know, we often talk about love as, you know, I give my heart to you. Well, there's actually some basis in physiology for that, which I'll show you, that the core of the social engagement mechanism is eyes and vagus nerve. And if you remember, the vagus nerve is crucial for the heart, right? We have, for those of you who've done anatomy, you may remember, we have these cranial nerves. We have 12 cranial nerves. And it turns out, which I didn't know in medical school, it turns out that 5 of them are absolutely crucial for social engagement. Again, showing you just the deep biologic nature of this. And one of the most important ones is the vagus nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, which innervates the heart and is connected to our autonomic nervous system. And so, again, this is deeply biological. Everybody's heard of their autonomic nervous system, I assume. The sympathetic nervous system is arousal. The parasympathetic nervous system is what quiets us. And it's this sort of yin and yang, this acceleration, break. And we're not taught, because I don't think it was really appreciated until recently, that the autonomic nervous system is actually what enables our social connection, which was a surprise to me. Because I'd learned it, you know, it was just sort of straight autonomic nervous system, which I think for those who took anatomy or neuroanatomy and stuff like that, that's what you were probably taught. But there's really interesting work that the autonomic nervous system, this eye-heart connection, the cranial nerves, and if you think about it, you know, if we're anxious in a relationship, that's sympathetic nervous system. If we feel safe and held, that's parasympathetic, quiet, connected, not fearful. But it's the autonomic nervous system that is what is absolutely crucial to social connection.
So the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system is all that whole system is the autonomic nervous system. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. The okay. autonomic nervous system is, if you look it up, I mean, I appreciate this is a busy slide, but this was the least busy slide I could find. But look up on it for people listening to this, look up autonomic nervous system, look at one of the images of it, and you'll see that, you can see that the sympathetic nervous system is arousal. The parasympathetic nervous system is slowing your heart. The sympathetic nervous system accelerates it. It's absolutely crucial for social engagement. Also, there's some of you may be familiar with it, what's called the hypothalamic pituitary axis. That's a fancy name for our stress axis. The base of our brain is the hypothalamus, and it releases corticotropin releasing factor that goes to our pituitary, which puts out a signal for our adrenal glands, which sit on top of our kidney, and there they put out stress hormones. They put out cortisol. This is our stress system. Our hormonal stress system is the hypothalamic pituitary axis. So I'll show you just how phenomenal this some of this is. I'd like you to just look at this picture. You'll notice that they give you four choices of emotions, and look at the eyes and make a guess as to which one it is. Don't try to figure it out. Just use your gut, your intuition. What are those eyes conveying?
For the folks listening, there's four choices: apologetic, friendly, uneasy, or dispirited.
Right, and the answer is uneasy, and the majority of you probably got it right. Another one, what are these eyes conveying?
And the four choices for those listening is playful, comforting, irritated, or bored.
Mm-hmm. And the answer is playful. And again, most people who saw this probably got it right. Now, step back and think about it for a moment. You saw grainy black and white photos of eyes. You didn't even see the whole face. You just saw grainy black and white photos of eyes, and you were able to discern accurately a complex emotion, not, you know, sad, happy, a complex emotion. And if it's extraordinary. And we do this, we do it all the time, and we're not even aware of it. If you've seen the movie actor Sacha Baron Cohen, this is his talented first cousin, Simon Baron Cohen. And he's got phenomenal work where, you know, we can identify it's something like 200 different complex emotions just looking at eye gaze. And if you look up his work, I mean, I just gave you two samples of numerous ones, but it's extraordinary. But what I hope you see is, again, the powerful biologic visual eye feeling connection that we all carry and are not particularly aware of it, because these are very specific adaptations that work in concert like a good orchestra. All right, so attachment, love, connection is literally seeing eye to eye. So the basis of the attachment mechanism is this early mother-infant attachment mechanism, and everything else is based on that. Now, we talked about mismatch. What's the problem with these pictures? Right. This is the mismatch between the environment we were evolved for and the environment we live in now. You notice none of these children are looking at each other. And these are just random pictures taken off of Google Images. There's not a single child looking at each other. Right. This is just random picture of college students. When I Googled college student images. Right. And again, if you notice, there's what, two, four, six, nine people in the two pictures, nobody's looking at each other. This I find extraordinary. One out of five 18 to 34-year-olds has texted during sex, you know, kind of getting in the way, I would argue. And obviously, learning about intimacy, learning about physical intimacy, learning about sex is very anxiety provoking. It doesn't help matters if you're on your phone texting somebody else. And this is a great piece of research that you want to know about. So these are two chairs, and there's a table, number two, and number one is a cell phone. And here's the design of the experiment. Imagine, if you would, that you're asked to come in and sit in this room in one of the chairs. And a complete stranger comes in and sits in the other chair. And you're asked just to carry on a conversation for 15 or 20 minutes. Complete stranger, and you converse with the other person. And you know that it's being filmed. It's being filmed. And then these films are watched by blind raters who rate the quality of the connection. And there's only one variable, and that's that iPhone on the desk. And so that iPhone, or just a mobile phone, is either on the desk or not on the desk. And the iPhone doesn't even belong to either of the participants. You're sitting in a room interacting with somebody, and there is or isn't a phone on the desk, right? And what they discovered, and it's worth looking at the paper, what they discovered is when there is an iPhone on the desk, there's inhibited closeness, there's inhibited trust, there's reduced empathy expressed between the participants, but the greatest effect is on any kind of meaningful interaction between the two parties. And again, the only variable is a mobile phone sitting on a desk. And I think it's fascinating. It's extraordinary. It made me, I now try to, if I interview a patient, my phone is nowhere to be seen. Fascinating. People are familiar with eating disorders, binging and purging. And there's really interesting evidence that it looks like one of the things that gets stimulated with binging and purging are the neurophysiology of attachment. When people who suffer this are binging and then purging, they're actually stimulating the neurophysiology of attachment. That's what they're trying to create. So it may be a response to aloneness, emptiness, loneliness, but that may be at least one of the contributors to something that plagues, obviously, a lot of primarily women. Also, self-injury, cutters. Non-suicidal self-injury, it looks as if one of the reasons is that the individuals are, again, trying to stimulate the neurobiology of attachment, of safety, connection, attachment. And if you think about it, it makes some sense, because if you cut yourself, you're stimulating endorphins, the anti-pain hormone. The non-suicidal self-injury, cutting, people are trying to stimulate connection, safety, that biological attachment. Again, why is this important? Because I think Dan Siegel says it nicely. We all want to feel felt. We all want to feel connection. And so when we are connected, it is a feeling. It is a biological phenomenon. It's a deeply biological phenomenon of safety, connection, attachment. And we heard about support groups. I think this helps us understand why support groups are so wonderful, why they're so crucial, why they're so effective, is because when support groups work well, we are felt, we're understood. There's literally at a crucial, deep biological level, there is that connection. We feel felt by other people, and they literally feel the things we feel. They've been through what we have, and we've made that connection. I'll give you a nice example of it. I work at a student health service 15 years ago. We never would graduate a patient who had bipolar disorder, particularly bipolar type 1. It just wasn't going to happen. We could never get them through to graduation. I never did. Worked hard and never did. And a nurse practitioner and a psychologist started a bipolar support group. This was a support group for patients who were students who had bipolar type 1, bipolar type 2. Now it is the rare occasion where somebody with bipolar disorder doesn't graduate. No change in the medications. I mean, I'm working just as hard trying to stabilize them with medications. But the one factor that has been put in is this very effective bipolar support group. quite extraordinary. So the other reason this is important is because this is also the placebo response. And it looks like, and there's really good information, that when the placebo response works, it is a physical, biological response. And it is that response of feeling safe, of feeling connected, so that you can deploy, it's safe to deploy the very expensive mechanisms, expensive energetically, expensive calorically, our immune system, it is safe to deploy those mechanisms. And, you know, a lot of that time, you're obviously going to be immobilized or resting, or you're going to be taken care of. But that may be what is at the foundation of the placebo response, is that attachment, safety, that deep biological connection.
And you had a comic panel there with two shelves of greeting cards, and the one on the left said "get well" and the one on the right says "placebo," and the gentleman is selecting a card from the placebo set of shelves.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, and again, if you're interested in this, Nicholas Humphrey, Current Biology on How We Heal, the deep biology of self-healing. And again, I'm going through this because when relationships rupture and people are plunged into aloneness and loneliness, we all have known it's bad, but it's even worse than we think. And people who leave religion, often their families exile them, they banish them, relationships are destroyed, and it's terrible. And of course, the religion comes from the word religare, which means to bind, to bond. Loneliness is devastating in its effects, and we want to do everything we can to counter it. Your risk of death goes up almost 1.5 times. You're much more vulnerable to cognitive decline and Alzheimer's. If you get depressed, the severity of your depression is worse if you were alone and lonely. It's a risk factor for suicide. Your sleep gets fragmented. You get increased inflammatory response in your body. Your body gets desensitized to your stress hormones. So you're putting out more stress hormones because it takes more stress hormones to do their job. You're at risk for hypertension. The obesity epidemic is connected actually to loneliness. And we do have an epidemic of loneliness. In the 1980s, maybe 10% of people would answer surveys and say they had no best friend. In some of the surveys now, 1 out of 4 people will say they have no best friend. There's really an epidemic of loneliness. And we know that when people leave religion, it can have devastating effects, particularly on family relationships, but even other relationships, devastating. You get diminished immunity. If you're alone and lonely and have a stroke, the size of the stroke is larger and functional recovery is less. So you want to, in a sense, monitor your own aloneness and loneliness, and you want to monitor the loneliness and aloneness of people you care about. This is going to sound odd, but loneliness is like fever or pain. It's an adaptation. It's designed to signal us that we're in danger, and it shifts to a short-term preservation mode, and you become vigilant. And the reason for this probably is that in the environment that we evolved in, if you were alone and lonely, that didn't last very long. You were probably dead. You're rejected from a social group. If you don't repair that, you're dead. And what we find in the modern world now is that loneliness gets triggered and it doesn't turn off. People can be alone and lonely for long periods of time and not die. But the devastation of that loneliness and aloneness is considerable. It's an ancient adaptation designed for us to quickly try to repair social bonds. But in the modern world, it can be jammed into fifth gear. You get increased cardiovascular stress. You get that increase in your hypothalamic pituitary axis, your stress hormones. Your immunity alters because you're preparing your body for injury. Because historically, if you were alone and lonely, you were at risk for predation by animals or other humans. And it's one of the things that triggers depression, which, as we talked about last time, is a signal for help. If you're interested in this subject, there's a psychologist, Cacioppo, in Chicago, who is like the world's expert on loneliness. He's got numerous papers. He's got books. He's got a great TED Talk that I would recommend. And so you want to be, I mean, none of us likes to be alone or lonely, but you want to be more sensitive to feelings of loneliness in yourself and also those you care about. I love this description of psychological suffering, unwilled, unwanted aloneness, loneliness in the face of overwhelming emotional experience. Diana Fosh is a psychologist who's invented a form of therapy that really looks at repairing attachment system. And again, there's an epidemic of loneliness in the modern world. And I think that loneliness and aloneness is one of the frequent and toughest outcomes when people have the courage and leave their religion. As I said, I think in one of my earlier talks, I live near Jerry Falwell's empire in Lynchburg, and I see students who were brought up in that, and they leave it, they leave the faith, they leave the Liberty family in Lynchburg, and it's devastating. The parents banish them, exile them. It's perfectly awful. And the connection between loneliness and aloneness was the classic paper on that is in Science in 1988. So even at the end of the last century, we knew about the devastation that loneliness and aloneness could have on physical and medical health. The original paper was in 1988, the classic House paper. Here's the most recent review article on it. Lack of social connection. Lack of connection is associated with chronic physical symptoms, frailty, coronary heart disease, malnutrition, hospital readmission. And this is interesting. Think about the pandemic. Reduced vaccine uptake. We're trying to vaccinate everybody. Think of how many lonely, alone people are getting vaccinated and their loneliness may be impairing their ability to take up the vaccine. Early mortality, depression, social anxiety, psychosis, cognitive impairment in later life, suicide. And these are the known effects of loneliness and aloneness on our physical health and mental health. I put this slide in to remind me of something that I think is tough for people who've left religion and their families. The Grant study, one of the long-term longitudinal studies that started in 1938 to measure long-term health and well-being, one of their findings was one of the things that was associated with well-being and long life was positive relationship with parents. And that can be hard if somebody has been exiled from a family. And I've shifted a little bit in my practice. And if it is possible, I try to help people repair at on an honest level, not submit. I mean, that's a no-go. That's a non-starter. But see if there are ways of repairing or keeping open the possibility of repair with parents, with family. I've seen this a number of times, and I used not to intervene if people said, well, they've written me off. I'm going to just write them off and try to go on with my life. And I've shifted a little bit, and I try to see, well, you know, let's see if we can at least see if we can repair on an honest way or to keep the possibility of that in mind, because the long-term payoff for well-being, I think, is there. The evidence is there. So that's agency, that's attachments. Let's look at altruism and the question of whether this is innate or whether this is learned. And I put this slide up there. I saw Gail, I think, react. This is Marine Sergeant Nicole G, who was one of the young Marines who was killed in the suicide attack in Kabul. And I put her up here for a couple of reasons. One, I think those pictures capture her altruistic behavior. And what I hope to show you is this is something that's not learned. And also that I I assume everybody here was upset too. There was no mention that this was a suicide terrorist attack based on religion, right? They don't say religiously based suicide terrorism, which I think they should. And I'm sure that suicide bomber was very religious. He thought he was doing a good thing. It upsets me that they don't mention that this was religiously based suicide terrorism that wiped out these 13 young soldiers who were, their mission was altruistic. And this is a picture that captures it. The other thing that is not known, and I'll make a little sidelight here, is that the history of modern suicide terrorism, Islamic, jihadist, Muslim suicide terrorism, the principal victims overwhelmingly are other Muslims. And if you go back to that suicide bombing in Kabul, it was 13 U.S. Servicemen. It was servicemen and women. It was 170 Afghan men, women, and children, over 10 times the number. This picture captured me when I saw it. I read about her and a basic altruistic individual. So the question is altruism innate or do we have to learn it? And what I want to make a case for is that altruism is something that's innate. Basically one of the reasons we're the last surviving hominid. We're an ultra-social, ultra-altruistic species. Do yourself a favor. Write down this man's name, Felix Warnikin. He's a child developmental psychologist researcher who was at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig. I think he's now at Harvard because of this work. But he and the group there did these beautiful experiments looking at altruistic behavior in human infants and in chimpanzees. And I think they've shown pretty clearly that we are much more altruistic than our closest cousins. But what's interesting is that we are born, just like I talked about, we're born with these attachment capacities, these attachment mechanisms. We're born with capacity for altruistic behavior. He's got a great TED Talk. But the other thing is, if you can just pull up his films, he's a very tall, gangly guy, and he's got these great experiments where he has these small children who can barely walk, who've never met him, trying to help him, and in complex behaviors. These are things that can't be taught, and these kids are just spontaneously trying to help him. They can identify a problem, they see he needs help, they know how to help him, they move to help him, and they're also just funny because he's so tall and they're so small. But do yourself a favor and watch his TED Talk and some of his other videos are posted. But I think the evidence is pretty clear that we are innately an altruistic species. And so a lot of well-being and happiness are things that you can intentionally do. You can practice. As somebody said, it's practicing everything they taught you in kindergarten. Again, no act of kindness or altruism is ever too small or wasted. Again, we are the most successful species because of our altruistic nature, our ultra-social, ultra-cooperative, ultra-altruistic nature. And some of that, I think, is impaired in the modern world. We lose the opportunity. And of course, in some cultures, they're highly individualistic cultures. The Marlboro man, he doesn't need anybody. I love Mark Twain. The best way to cheer yourself up is to try to cheer someone else up. And there's a psychologist who I think has a great piece of advice. If you're feeling depressed, if you're feeling sad, go help somebody. And regardless of what you think of the Dalai Lama and Buddhism, the Dalai Lama's got some great comments that are empirically supported. I like this one. Be kind whenever possible. It's always possible. The more you care about the happiness and well-being of others, the greater will be your own sense of well-being and happiness. And again, the research, I think, bears that out. I like this one, altruism. You comes before I. Happiness is spending on others. We're getting close to the end. I'd like you to do a little experiment here with me. If you would, just close your eyes and imagine getting a gift for a friend and giving it to them. Just try to do that in your mind for a minute. Imagine getting a gift and giving it to a friend. Okay, thank you. Now, if we had you in an MRI when you did that, your nucleus accumbens would light up. That's the area of your brain for pleasure. You just got the same hit in your brain as you did if you'd eaten a brownie. It's that powerful. And so altruistic behavior is innate and it is rewarding at a deep level. This research actually comes out of Harvard Business School, and that spending on others makes you happier than spending on yourself. Harvard Business School. I love this cartoon. It's for those that are on the phone. It's an old man in bed dying. He's holding the hand of maybe his son, and he's saying to him, I should have bought more crap. What it turns out is no, that material wealth is not going to give you well-being long-term. And that goes against the cultural grain, but that's what the research shows. And if you step back from it, of course, I mean, for most of our evolutionary history, our ancestors did not have material wealth. Their happiness and well-being came from their connections with other people. Again, the research shows that the main thing you can do is to spend time with, and good time, quality time with people you care about who care about you. I mean, that's one of the bottom lines here.
You made an excellent point, Dr. Andy, because I'm a genealogist. I do a lot of genealogy research, and I often kind of try to put myself in people's shoes who I find back in the early 1900s or the 17th century or beyond. And I'm thinking, if I was in there, I'd be so miserable. It'd be such hard work. There'd be dirt floors and just work. But, kind of what you're, just because they're dirt poor, but kind of what you're saying is like, that doesn't really matter at all, does it?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that the people that have assayed stress hormone levels, the people have actually assayed stress hormone levels in the existing hunter-gatherers, which are very few. And surprise, surprise, their stress hormone levels are lower than ours. And also, people who've looked at it argue that their quality of closeness, their quality of relationships is actually often deeper and better than ours. Because they're mutually dependent on each other for their literal survival, which I think makes a difference.
Yeah, I can see that. Totally see that. And from my point of view, or from where I'm at right now, depending on others feels kind of scary, yeah. But we do it all the time anyways. I think maybe depending on strangers is kind of what I'm hearing might be scary, but...
I mean, we're all dependent on strangers. I mean, I'm dependent on somebody who built this microphone, who provides the electricity, who, provides the water. I've got clean water. I mean, we're mutually interdependent on more people than we know or could count. But yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean,
that's a good point.
The people that did the coding for Zoom, the people who built Zoom, the people who built the internet. I mean, we're mutually interdependent on more people than we, know. So the idea of rugged individualism, I think, is nonsense.
Yeah, and I'm getting a deeper sense of that because I'm looking at you on a monitor, and there were people who built that. There were people who built the machines to build that. There were engineers who designed it, and administrators and managers that were. Was just with this one monitor. There's probably hundreds and hundreds of people that I relied on in order to connect with you.
Yeah, the people who did the coding for PowerPoint. I mean, it's endless, right? And we're mutually interdependent on all these people. It's different, obviously, than our hunter-gatherer ancestors. We don't see them face to face, which is a deficiency. But we're mutually highly interdependent. This is a graph that just shows that poverty will buy you a lot of misery, but a lot of money will not make you happy. And there's research that if you have an annual income of $70,000-$80,000 a year, once you get above that, you're not going to be any happier. And the research actually shows that if you earn over $10 million a year, your happiness goes down, probably in part because you can't trust that people who are your friends because of you or because of your money. Touch. That's the last thing that, again, I include touch in altruistic behavior because touch is crucial, wanted touch. So, and we talked about this, I think, in the religion talk. Right now, if your partner came and, you know, put their hand on your shoulder, the idle speed of your frontal lobe would relax. You'd get a rush of oxytocin and endorphins, and it would facilitate the bonding. You know, just simple touch is absolutely crucial. Think of how much touch we've lost in the pandemic. Think of how little touch you have if you're alone and lonely. It is far more powerful than we imagine. I didn't show you this when we were talking about in religion, but there's a fascinating study that showed that the basketball teams that were the best basketball teams were the teams that touched each other the most. And these are the 2008 Celtics, Boston Celtics, who won the NBA championship that year. Look at all the touching that's going on. This is the starting five. Everybody's got their hand on each other. It's fascinating. And I love this one of Rondo. And number five, blacking on his name. The center. But he was famous in the studies because every time he took a foul shot, before he took a foul shot, within just a few seconds, he had reached out and touched every one of his teammates on the foul line. So they give him the ball to take a shot, and he reaches out, touches all of his teammates before he shoots the foul shot. And so, again, touch is very powerful and part of attachment, part of that connection. So
our chat is saying that number five is Kevin Garnett.
Ah, thank you. I hate losing my memory. Thank you, whoever that was. We're going to end with gratitude. And I'm sure all of you've heard some of the research that comes out of the psychology of well-being, the of happiness and gratitude journals, that kind of thing. And I think, and a lot of people go, really? Come on. And no, this is important. And again, I would put it under the umbrella of altruism, that gratitude, expressions of gratitude are another manifestation of our altruism. And that, again, gratitude is also an attitude, which reminds me of one thing I didn't mention when we talked about attachments. When you walk into a room of strangers, do you see it as us or do you see it as them? Right. I think that makes a difference. Gratitude is an attitude. And when you appreciate the good, those things that are good will appreciate, will increase. Research shows that. So gratitude, expressions of gratitude to people has all sorts of ramifications. And so what I would like to do is to end this talk, and we'll do sort of a group exercise of gratitude. And this comes from some of the work of Melvin Connor, an anthropologist, psychiatrist at Emory. And so what I'd like you to do is just take a moment here and to think about all of the literally hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people that lived in the time before history, the last couple million years, our hominid ancestors. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors in Africa. And we will never know their names. We will never know their faces. We know they existed, but their only legacy is, in a sense, in us. And the argument here is that we owe a lot to those hunter-gatherer ancestors. We should be deeply grateful to them. We should try to feel that gratitude. And be grateful to them for our happiness, our well-being, our resilience. Because most of us, most of the time, incline towards happiness, even in this difficult world where everything fades and we lose so much. Most of the time, most of us lean towards happiness, lean towards well-being and resilience. And most of the time, we're glad to be alive. And if our ancestors, our hunter-gatherer ancestors had not been that way, they could have hardly accomplished what they did. They lived lives far harder than our lives for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years. And if they had failed to adapt to the difficulties of life, the hard knocks, they'd not have survived. And all of us here tonight are their living legacy. All of the 7 billion people in the world today are their living legacy. Now, obviously, we do take heart. We do take things to heart. We grieve, we get depressed, we stumble, we fall, we despair at times. But most of the time, eventually, we bounce back. We can cast a hopeful gaze at the horizon. We'll again get up, we'll lean into the wind, we'll make determined steps for the future. And that we get from them. And to try to feel in your heart, in your minds, gratitude to them, and to see what effect it has on you now, this evening, and even later today, tomorrow. And what I'd like to close with is that I think the task before, particularly my profession, the mental health community, but I think the task for all of us is how do we incorporate this knowledge about happiness and well-being and resilience into, for instance, the people who are alone and lonely, who have had the courage to leave religion and are now suffering a lot of the consequences. You know, how do we bring this knowledge to bear for them, which this group does, I think, so well? How do we bring this knowledge to, if you're in the mental health business, to the treatment of your patients, if you're any kind of healthcare professional, how do you bring this knowledge to your patients? And how do we bring this both as healthcare professionals, but just citizens of the world, to the traumatized individuals, to the chronically mentally ill, to the people we know live in the shadow of life? I would submit to you that is one of our challenges. Thank you for being here tonight. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
Wow. Dr. Andy, thank you so much.
I'm kind of left a little speechless because I don't know how you packed in so many amazing points in such a short time. that was just really amazing.
Thank you.
At the end, your last slide you had is memoriam of Ed Diener. Can you briefly describe who he was?
He's the man, Ed and Carol Diener. Ed Diener is the man who started the revolution in the psychological science of well-being and happiness. The slide I showed at the beginning.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And sadly, he recently died.
So many thoughts are going through my head. And this has been very enlightening and has kind of helped me kind of refocus basically what the title of this was, is just happiness in the time of plague. I just really, really appreciate it. We have got some questions. Do you want to start us off, Sherry?
Yes, we've actually had some really fantastic questions. I know we focused on happiness versus satisfaction, but another word that's synonymous with some of these expressions is contentment. So could you make a comment on that word contentment, and is it truly synonymous with happiness or satisfaction?
Well, again, I think it demonstrates some of the complexities of this, because all of us know what contentment is. All of us feel like we have an idea of what contentment is. But like, I think happiness and well-being, when you dig deep at what all the pieces of contentment are, I think it becomes more complicated. I think contentment is closer to satisfaction, to life satisfaction, but it, or maybe a precursor. Contentment is when you feel safe, where things are calm. And I think one of the things that's unappreciated is generally, if you're feeling content, I think if anybody thinks about it, if they're feeling content, even though they may not be conscious of it at the moment that they're feeling that contentment, I would wager you serious money that they are well connected to some other people. Mm. They've got some good, deep attachments in their life.
Right.
And I think that often gets missed when we think about it.
What I'm hearing is happiness is maybe a momentary or shorter term type of emotion, but contentment is maybe a longer term set of happiness strung together. Okay.
Yeah. Just like life satisfaction is different from happiness.
Do you have any book recommendations on living, like kind of maybe goes more in depth on some of the topics we talked about here and how to possibly live a happier or higher well-being life? Anything that come to mind?
I think there's a lot out there. And I think what you want to do is just to look at the books, look at the reviews, see which ones speak to you. Marty Seligman has a book on flourishing, and he's one of the founders. He was one of Ed Diener's students. He was one of the founders of the positive psychology movement. There's a Russian psychologist, Luborsky, I think it's out, who's done a lot of work. She's got books. But I think probably, and there are new books just coming out all the time. And my suggestion would be to, you know, look at the new titles, look at some of the old titles, read the reviews, and see which ones seem to speak to your interest. As I said, it's just been a revolution since the 1990s. The Happiness Hypothesis by John Haidt is one of the original ones. The Harvard researcher Daniel Gilbert has a book, Stumbling Towards Happiness. John Haidt, The Happiness Hypothesis. Flourish by Martin Seligman. The woman who I mentioned, Sonia Lyubomirsky, The Myths of Happiness. There's just a lot of books out there. And I would, and if you find a book that you thought was particularly good, I would love to hear it. If you found something that you thought was particularly good. And my contention obviously is that if you look at all this research, all of it will, I think all of it comes under the umbrellas of agency, attachment, and altruism.
Really interesting. The discussion point of attachment and eyes, I found that fascinating. That was really, really interesting about what we get out of the expression in eyes and that connection. It made me recall a conference I went to in 2017 where we had to do an exercise, all those that were attending, to look at the person next to us who was a stranger that we'd never met before, and we had to maintain a full 60 seconds of direct eye contact. Mm-hmm. It was such a powerful, I will never forget that sense of connection that I then had with this complete stranger that I'd never met before. But just having that eye contact, the things that we then saw in each other's expression, it just made such a lasting impression on me. I wonder what your thoughts are on the effects of COVID and mask wearing and the challenges we have through a pandemic of actually connecting with other humans.
Well, I would be interested to hear other people's ideas now that they've heard this, because I hope one of the things you can see is how much the pandemic and social distancing and masks and, you know, absence of touch, all the things that go into biologic connection, and particularly the things that you just mentioned, that direct, powerful, eye-to-eye, face-to-face contact, and how much of that has been missing for the last, you know, I'm losing track of time. What is it, 18, 20 months now, something like that. I mean, it's awful.
It feels like
it's still going on, and it's still going on.
Yeah, it is.
My university masks are now, everybody's got to be fully vaccinated, but you're expected, you have to wear masks indoors.
Yeah.
Classes, when I see patients in a building, we have to be masked.
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult time to go through, and I'm sure there'll be some very interesting research in years to come on what the impact psychologically that the pandemic has had on us. Dr. Thompson, during the discussion, the traffic lights stood out to me, mm-hmm. about the green being when you feel safe, the orange when there's danger present, and that's where our fight flight comes into play, and then the red, the crisis point where we can be immobilized, which I think is the freeze response. Yes. I have recently learned and heard, and I saw a bit of comments in the chat about a fourth response, which has been called something different. Like in Australia, I've heard it as appease. But others in the chat had heard it as feign or fawn or submit. Yeah. Do you have any comments on that fourth response?
I think that can happen. Submissive behavior. But you're getting anxious. I would maybe put that somewhere between the green and the yellow.
Right. Interesting.
Submissive behavior.
Yeah. It resonated with me because I suppose everybody does when they see that traffic light, they kind of can pick out when instances have happened to themselves in their own personal experience. Many years ago, I worked for a bank and a bank holdup occurred and I was actually the teller that got held up. Yay me. And I froze. I just completely froze, completely immobilized. Right. So it actually is helpful to me now, looking back, to understand what processes were going on in here at the time.
Right. And you couldn't have done any differently.
No.
No, it's just automatic and voluntary.
Yes. Yeah. Makes much more sense to me.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to come up with a four-color traffic light here. We'll have yellow. Maybe yellow, purple, I don't know. No, green, yellow, green, something like that. But because the submissive behavior will often come in. I think that's a good point.
Right.
So, Dr. Andy, you may not be able to answer this, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. COVID, as we well know, is a very deadly disease, and it was just the right decision for us to social distance and separate ourselves from the population. But we, as you kind of showed, and some of the research shows, loneliness and being alone shortens our lifespan. What are your thoughts on how much shorter, what have we lost in lifespan perhaps just from separating ourselves from one another through this pandemic and feeling alone so often? I know it's hard to generalize for the 7 billion people, but do you have any thoughts on that at all?
I think all of us have probably shortened our lives a little bit. And I hope I'm wrong, but I think we may have all shortened our lifespans a little bit with all the stress of the pandemic. And I think it's going to be proportional to how much people have been hit. I mean, I know some people have been, more ill and more isolated than others, but I think it's had a big impact. I wish there'd been more public education about it. I mean, we're asking people to do something that is stressful, that is difficult. We need to be aware of that. We need to try to find ways around loneliness and aloneness, but we're having to induce it to try to control the pandemic. I think more public education would have been helpful, and maybe there'd been more cooperation and more creative ways. I mean, I don't know about you all, but thank God for Zoom.
Yes.
Yeah.
figuratively. Or thank those engineers. Thank whatever engineers did that.
Definitely. I've just noticed another really good question in the chat. This question raises a good point about where personality comes into play. So this person who's asked the question says, what does all this say for someone like me with an avoidant personality disorder? I've never had a best friend. I could not read the emotions in those eye pictures. And then in brackets, would I have survived a hunter-gatherer upbringing?
I think the pandemic, I don't know. That's a very interesting question. The pandemic may have been harder, but it may not have been as hard because you already adapted to being isolated. Not being able to read those eye pictures, that's more Asperger's autism spectrum than avoidant personality. Simon Baron Cohen is the man that figured out Asperger's and autism, and he thinks it's the difficulty in being able to read other people's emotions from eye gaze. People with Asperger's and people who are on the spectrum can't read those pictures. Would you be somebody who survived in a hunter-gatherer tribe, they think that people with Asperger's are systematizers. People with Asperger's are very good at figuring out complex systems, and Asperger's actually has some advantages. That's why it has survived. It, you know, a lot of our scientists, a lot of our engineers, there's high rates of Asperger's in engineers. So I would say if you had trouble reading those eyes, maybe you're on the spectrum, and you would be able to come up with novel solutions to difficult problems. You could focus and might have been indispensable to a group. Asperger's wouldn't be here if it hadn't had utility for our evolutionary history.
Yeah, so folks with autism have been with us for, you know, as long as we've been around. And they, like you said earlier, we were never really alone. We were a part of a group, small group. And so we'd all be taking care of one another.
Right. And so, that's a great point, Eric, because somebody in a hunter-gatherer tribe, people would be dependent on you. Mm-hmm. And so they would take care of you. Okay. Maybe you're not good at relationships, but they would have relationships with you. I mean, you wouldn't be left alone.
You know, and some of the trickiest things that we've managed to come up with, napping flint to come up with arrow points or spears, looking at this green mineral in the ground and creating copper or bronze out of it. Some of these things are like incredible jumps, and I don't think they could have been made by somebody like me. Right. They might have been may have been someone on the spectrum who thought well outside of the box, unlike anybody else could have.
No, I mean, that's a fabulous point. I'm gonna quote you forever on that. Seriously, because no. Look, I mean, that's one of the. If you read the stuff about human evolutionary history, bipedalism was crucial, but the next thing they think was crucial was being able to nap stone tools. Having the patience to nap stone tools, and we could probably wager that the original guys that did that were on the spectrum. They would have kept at it.
Yeah, I would have given up pretty darn quickly. And we can see just how many incredible different shapes and utilities have been made just from that one different technology, simple technology. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or complex technology.
Those may have been guys on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't have been left alone, as unfortunately in the modern world, again, getting back to mismatch, too many of my Asperger's patients live alone. And they're isolated, and it's just awful.
Dr. Andy, thank you so much again. Another fantastic time. Yeah.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering From Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the Volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.